What we've been doing so far is rather obvious. We've been dealing with Revelation, especially as we find it in the Old Testament. Coming down to very practical things today, as we have gone through the idea of revelation through the name of God, revelation through the Word of God, revelation in the history of man. And now that revelation has come to one individual from God. It is from God down toward man. And today we want to ask the question of ourselves, what is man according to the Bible? Who are you? What's the important part about your life? One of the amazing things that happens every week at Holden Village is that in spite of the fact that we come from various parts of the world and various parts of the Lutheran Church, there almost seems to be some kind of collusion between the faculties when we start to speak. 2 weeks ago when I was here, there was a Missouri Synod pastor who was speaking on economics, and he and I got into the same subject that we're going to get into today. Now we have two other faculty members, one talking about the New Testament, another one talking about the life in the artist or in the poet, and I'm talking about the Old Testament. We're all celebrating the same thing, celebration of the flesh, or the re-emphasis of man in history and Jesus Christ as man in history. You might be interested, those of you who did your homework for Ivar would be interested in seeing this quotation. It makes good sense. Man is a dynamic experiencer. His flesh appears to him as a medium through which he meets the world. Far from being alien to his mind, it is the source of its life. It nourishes his whole consciousness by placing him in vital relationship with the real. And in the New Testament Bible study, Paul has been taking 1 John, which deals with the heresy that has crept into the Lutheran Church, which was once known as Gnosticism, the heresy which tried to divide man into two parts, the world into two parts, and everything like this. Now, let's start with the easy part first. If this revelation is coming to us, we know it's coming from a creator. It's coming from the one who not only made us, but who also redeemed us and ancient Israel, the creator. Our problem is that we are a creature. An Old Testament definition of God might be something like this. God is the holy Lord of the covenant who created his own people. And who am I? I could take an Old Testament definition and summarize everything that I plan to say today by saying this. Man is a creature who has rebelled against the holy Lord of the covenant. Let's just look at this first part. Man is a creature, and as a creature, he's therefore less than God. He can't think of himself as being primarily God himself. Nature is also part of this creation of God. And nature is not alien to man. It's not the enemy of man. It is part and parcel of that which he has said. Someone has said that the Old Testament protects Christianity from the temptation of separating man into two parts or separating man from nature. Think of Genesis 1. Think of Psalm 8, think of Psalm 103, Psalm 104, think of Job 38 and following. They all celebrate the relationship of man and nature under a great creator God. Now, if this is true, man then is a dependent creature. We'll see tomorrow that his attempt to be independent, autonomous, is the heart of Old Testament sin. Man is dependent on God. God is not dependent on man. There's no such question asked in the Old Testament as why did God create man? This is a question that the Old Testament never bothered with. They were interested, you remember, from the first day, not in thought and speculation, but in actions and in facts. God did something, and we appreciate it. We respond to it. We don't ask the question why in the Old Testament. Now, Christian theology, this is something else again. It can ask the question why. One interesting thing about the Old Testament when it uses this word, We won't make a lot of this, but somebody theologically censored the Bible through the oral tradition and through the vocabulary that was used, through editing as it finally came into our hand. The Hebrew word, bara, which is translated create, never has any other subject but God. Now, I'm sure in popular Hebrew speech, I'm sure when we find this word in Semitic languages related to Hebrew, we'll find the word El or some other God as the subject. But in the present state of our Hebrew text, over years and years of tradition, man or a person other than God is never the subject of the verb create. Everything from mouse to man is created by God. Man can make, man can produce, man can form, man can compose, or if you wish to use artistic words, he can draw or he can paint, but he cannot create. This is the Old Testament point of view. To this then, to be a man is nothing to be escaped from. Some people think that to be a man in itself is sinful. To be a man or a woman or a human being in itself is sinful. This is not true. Man is not to escape from himself. Man is not to try to escape the world or escape the flesh, as it's sometimes called, or to escape the devil in the sense of running away. Life is under God. Now, this is reemphasized by a doctrine which is most frequently misunderstood. Man is created in the image of God. There are three or four things that are involved in this image of God. The first thing is obvious. There are some Old Testament scholars who think that these three or four things that I'm going to put on the board are contradictory, and you must take a choice. And you must say, this is the whole truth. This is false. The Old Testament has angles of vision just as the New Testament does. As a different point might look at a different type of tree or a different animal or the same experience and come up with quite a different response. So the Old Testament prophets and the Old Testament theologians had different points. Now, in the book of Genesis, the one that seems to be clear is dominion over the earth. Now, we have misused that phrase frequently in order to mean that man is so sovereign over nature that he can do with it what he pleases. That isn't what it is. He does it under God. He is the vice regent. He is the present landlord. He is the tenant farmer under God. Now, absentee landlordism is one of the things you fight against now in economics and sociology. But actually, this is the point of view of the Old Testament. God is an absentee landlord, except when he makes himself present through prophets, through kings, through priests, and finally through Jesus Christ. And man is his supervisor. Man is the resident manager of the apartment house, if you want to put it that way. Man is the one who does the work for God here on this earth. So, you can say, this is dominion over all the earth. Let us make man in our own image. And then he says, let him do this and let him do this and subdue the earth. This is frequently said. A second way in which we can add to this is that man is a responsive and responsible creature. Responsive and responsible. Now, this means that anything that God has created, anything that God does, be it historical or otherwise, calls for two responses by man. One, a response in joy, the celebration of the flesh that some of us have heard about recently here. I don't like that term, but we'll get to that reason I don't in a moment before we end up here today. It's just the term I don't like. I like the idea very much. But he is responsive to what he sees in the world and in the flesh and in the creation of God.
But he is also, and here you go back to the number one, he's also responsible for his own responses and responsible for what is remaining there. How could you have revelation? Remember, that's the whole theme of this course, if man was incapable of receiving it. So the image of God in man, according to some scholars, and I believe it's part of the story, is the ability of man to respond to revelation, and this includes the revelation in the Word, in the Bible, in the Christian church, in history, and in nature, to respond to it and then to be responsible for what he has received. This is part of the image of God in man. Now, third thing comes out of this responsible and responsiveness. In fact, this is the part that makes for the possibility of sin. Man is self-determinative. Man is not an automaton. He is not a robot. Man has some ability to choose. Although Paul sometimes uses the idea of slavery, this slavery is only after we have been enslaved by the devil. The whole purpose of Genesis 3 is to indicate that in the image of God, our responsiveness and our responsibility allowed for self-determination, which could be in error, in sin, in rebellion. And this is involved. Man has this opportunity. Walter Eichrode, who's a fine Old Testament scholar, has a real nice phrase, which you would probably say sounded much more important if you said it in German. Well, I won't say it in German, but he ties up these two things. The image of God in man, he said, is the self-determining, self-conscious personality of man. Self-determining, self-conscious personality of man. This doubles these two together here. Now, the fourth thing that the image of God contains is something that you probably have all missed. That is this. Man is a unity. Mankind is a unity. Jesus said one time in the New Testament, "My Father and I are one." This also can be said of man as he was created. Man, before he rebelled and became alien and disrupted this oneness. The image of God created in man a oneness. This oneness goes two ways. The oneness of person and the oneness of humanity. I'm going to take the second one first because it's easier and more readily acceptable. The unity of mankind, or the unity of humanity, is part of the image of God. You remember how clearly the Shema in Deuteronomy states it? "Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is one." And if we are in the image of God, we are one. The brotherhood of the faith, the fellowship of the church, the ability of mankind to be related to one another, this is part of the image of God. Man is related to God, yes, but man is also interrelated to all the other creatures of God. One of the things that's surprising to most people in the Old Testament is that there are no hermits. There are no real ascetics. Everybody belongs to a society. And the society is interconnected so that you can't separate a man from his society without causing him to be almost dead. You see, man was made for society and man lives in society. And this gives us a new concept that some of you may have heard of and some of you may not have heard of. It's called corporate personality. One of the famous English Old Testament scholars invented the phrase, Wheeler Robinson. Corporate personality means that a social group, a social unity, or ideally all mankind, and especially in the Christian church, all Christians, are so mutually interrelated that you can't hurt one without hurting the other. That one can redeem the other just as one can destroy the other. Let's use some illustrations from the scripture to make this clear, first of all. Remember the story of Sodom and Gomorrah? It's one of the better stories in the Bible that children remember because they aren't supposed to. This is the kind of thing that we hear a lot about. But we forget the fact that Sodom and Gomorrah had lots of people in them. And Abraham and Lot had an opportunity. God gave them the opportunity. If you can find so many righteous people, we'll save the whole blooming lot. Now, we won't get into the idea of foreknowledge or predestination. God already knew he had the thing all won, you know, because he knew they weren't going to find that many, so he wasn't really taking a gamble. We could decide that right now if we wanted to, but that isn't the point of the lesson. The lesson is that the offering was there, that through the faith of a few, through the loyalty of a few, the whole could be saved. This actually became the mission of Israel, didn't it? Why was Abraham called? Not because God loved Abraham. Why was Israel called? Not because Israel was the best of all people. Abraham was called, Israel was called, so that you might become a great nation and all the nations of the earth might be blessed in you. There's that unity again. Why is there a church? Why should the church go into all the world? To make the promise that Abraham and Israel flunked come true. Not just to make the church more prestigious, not to make the church larger, but so that all humanity can once again be related to God in this same way. Man is this way. Now take it to the opposite side. If one could redeem, and this of course allows for Jesus Christ later on, or as the Jews sometimes, the Messiah or the remnant could save all the rest of us, this corporate personality, you have the opposite side. You remember the story of Joshua at Jericho? They weren't supposed to take any loot. And one little GI said to himself, well, they won't miss it if I take it and put it in my tent. And so he took it. And Joshua couldn't figure out why, after being so successful at Jericho, he got licked pretty badly at Ai. He couldn't get up into the hill country. Now, we might have all kinds of military explanations for that. But the scripture's explanation is that the whole people had been guilty. Corporate personality had made them all guilty because of this stinking little GI named Achan. We call it Achan's theft sometimes when there are Sunday school lessons. Now, we Americans who believe so much in individual responsibility say, that's cruel. Why should the whole people be punished because of the one guy? Why not let him bear his punishment? Or vice versa. We wouldn't want to let one man. This is why so many non-Christians have trouble with Jesus Christ. How can one man save the sins of all? Well, it's easy. Achan was Israel. Israel was Achan. And the two could not be separated. Jesus Christ is the church, and the church is Jesus Christ, and you can't separate them now. There is this total unity of humanity, which is redeemed now in the New Testament through Christ. Mankind is a whole, you see, and all the Old Testament people, as well as the New Testament church, have this mission. Even marriage fits into this. Everybody and his brother seems to want to take books on love, sex, and marriage around here as the reading thing, because that seems to be the new kick. But even marriage, it is not good that a man should be alone. And that isn't only about marriage. This is about hermits. It's about ascetics. It's about people without a family. It's about the fact that it's not good that a man be isolated. This is involved. Marriage is one way of getting over it, or else it's one way and a hell of a way to find out that you're lonelier still. And this is, of course, part of the problem of marriage today, that lonely people get married and find out they're lonelier than they ever were before. Because until you've seen the light, you don't know how dark it is. And this is sometimes the trouble. So mankind is a unity. In the New Testament, we have messianic passages that we refer sometimes to Jesus. In the Old Testament, they were referred to David. Or they were referred to a Messiah of some other imagery. Jews and Christians and various scholars of both denominations or religions argue with each other as to, was this a promise to this individual or that individual or this group of people, or was it really just Jesus Christ that was involved? The answer is, the Greeks classified, Western scientists classified, but Jews didn't. So David was the people. And when David was re-enthroned, and when David entered a new covenant, the people had a new covenant. And if David sinned, the people sinned. If Hezekiah got sick, the people were sick. If Hezekiah sinned, the people lost a battle. You remember these stories. There was such a unity of the people and the king that what happened to the one happened to the other. Not by cause and effect. This is not it. It didn't happen as if, well, you pushed over Poland and Czechoslovakia falls, or vice versa, the kind of Hitler strategy, a bunch of dominoes in warfare. It isn't that if you knock the king, then all his subordinates go down too. It's that they really are together. They really belong together. In the suffering servant passage of Isaiah 53, there are hundreds of interpretations. This is Jeremiah. This is the prophet himself. This is the remnant. This is Israel over in the exile. This is Jesus Christ. And some people come out so flat-footed and said it can only be one or the other and nothing more. But if you understand what this is, that there's unity of mankind, then the suffering servant is all of these things. It's all of humanity that is suffering. It's all of Israel that's suffering. It's that poor doubting prophet named Jeremiah. It's the prophet himself. It's the remnant over in Babylon. It's the people who maybe were holding true to the faith in spite of Pharisees, Sadducees, Essenes, Zealots, and the rest. And it is Jesus Christ. But don't stop there. This is where the Christians too often stop. They say, oh yes, Isaiah 53. That's about Jesus Christ. Now I've already given you the whole prelude. It's more than Jesus Christ. But remember, there's a postlude. It's also a description of the Christian church. You, as the Christian church, are the suffering servant, and we try to get into the suburban security system. This is a passage which has something to say to us, too. It isn't just this. All right, now, if Christ is the church and the church is Christ, if Achan is Joshua's army and Joshua's army is Achan, if Abraham can save Sodom, Christ and his church can be the ones to make the whole world blessed because of this unity of mankind. Now, that's corporate personality. Now, the usual thing that most of the people who talk about God is dead are fighting, they're fighting a little straw man, of course, is that there was maybe a fifth idea beyond this, and it's not there. But they often put it here, and I'll put it up here and then exit out right away so you don't get mixed up because it's the transition to this part here. And that is that man is the image of God in that it means formal image, maybe even build, or the architectonics of man's development. This is not true. The word is just not used that way in the Old Testament. Man is something else. Man is a unity, and he is a whole person. He is not divided.
He is not divided into body and soul.
This is a Greek concept that John was fighting already in Ephesus. It is a Greek concept that Paul let get into the church because he was speaking missionary language. When you go to a foreign country and you want to say what you want to say, you have to know how they would say it in their terms. So if you then use their terms, it can be misunderstood by people who only know the missionary language and don't know the original language. And this is what's happened. We now talk about body and soul. The Gnostics did it and Christians do it. When I am called to serve the living God, it's like the old song, "Come and take all of me." It was an old love song, actually, but all of me. Hebrew poetry gives you the answer very quickly to this kind of thing, just as I just put it. Psalm 103, verse 1, has what I call, and every other Old Testament person says, the form of Hebrew poetry is parallelism. Most of the time, it's what we call synonymous parallelism. So that if you don't know what the thing says, read the next half of the verse, it'll tell you. This is all you have to do. It's as simple as that. And if it has the word "but" in it, or "yet" in it, well, then you have the opposite of synonymous parallelism. So if you don't know what one half reads, read the next half, it'll tell you what it ain't. So you'll be able to get the contrast. Now, look at this. "Bless the Lord, O my soul. All that is within me, bless his holy name." Now, we already found that the word "Lord" and "holy name" are equals and parallels. The word "bless" is not only parallel, it's identical. So if you want to know what a soul is, just read the second half of the first verse of Psalm 103. It's all of me. It's as simple as that. Now, in the Hebrew, there is a term, nephesh, which is translated, unfortunately, in the King James Bible by the word soul. And it also, in the Greek, is translated by a word, psyche, which is gets into our psychology, you see. And this becomes soul, too. This is the Greek, and this is the Hebrew. Nephesh and psyche. Now, our problem is that we think nephesh and psyche are equals. They're not. The Greek concept of soul and the Hebrew concept are completely different. Even the King James Bible knew they were making a mistake in one passage. Only one passage in the whole King James Bible did they do this correctly. Every time nephesh and psyche came, you had the word soul, except in John 10. "The good shepherd giveth his suke for the sheep." Now, this is crucial to my whole argument, to the whole Hebrew understanding. This is a Hebrew concept, but they use the Greek word. "The good shepherd giveth his suke for the sheep." Now, every other New Testament passage that the King James translated, they used the word soul. But all of you know by heart, they didn't use the word soul there, did they? They used the word life. A much larger concept in English. Much larger. Because they knew, as you know from reading any of the Gospels and even reading the sermons in the New Testament, Jesus Christ gave more than some little flutterby. Some little part of him. He gave his all, his totality, his whole. Emotions and sinews and marrow and blood and water and agony of mind and spirit, whatever you want to do it, he gave his suke. Now that's the all of me, do you see? Even the New Testament knew it, and even the King James people knew it, but they were so brainwashed by Platonism for 2,000 years that they couldn't get away from it. Now let's go back and see what we're talking about. See if how that little glimpse that somehow the Holy Spirit got through that committee that King James appointed and got the truth spoken, at least in one spot.
The word snephesh, almost 50% of the time, is evenly divided between the two things that we say are physical and spiritual. Now, this is our category, not Hebrew. You know, we say Sunday is spiritual, Sunday is sacred, Saturday is profane, especially Saturday night. That's the most profane of all. But even some of us have gotten to the idea that Monday morning is Sunday, is not Sunday, is profane. And radio announcers all go around on that TGIF bit. Thank God it's Friday. No, you know, you get over this work and horrible slavery that you've got, and now you can go out and relax. 50% of the time, nephesh, the Hebrew word, is translated by what we would have to do, a context of physical things. The other 50% are what we would categorize as spiritual things. The best illustration of the first is King David, before he was king. Poor guy was out as a guerrilla warrior. He didn't always get the best of food the way we do here at Holden. He had to scrounge for the berries the way the poor little brown bears do. He got so hungry once, he said, "My soul is famished." What did he do? Did he get down on his knees and pray? Did he offer a sacrifice? No, he went into the temple and surreptitiously stole the bread that only priests were supposed to eat, and he ate it. He said, "My soul is satisfied." Now, instead of using the word soul, we should have used, "My stomach is growling." Or we should have said, "I'm famished." Or we should have translated that, "I have a horrible appetite." And this is what we would have said. And when we see the words, "My soul thirsteth after God," we make this all spiritual. Tain't so. We would say this was spiritual, wouldn't we? I mean, sure, he's hunger, his stomach growling, his intestines working over the bread, this satisfied his soul. No, we wouldn't say that, but they did, and I think it's true. We'll get to this a little bit in a moment. But thirsting after God with my whole soul also could mean I'm hungry. And I could thirst after God just by seeing what's around Holden. I can satisfy it by what's around Holden, by the people I know. I don't have to always come to the 12 o'clock prayer session. And only because Carol makes me do we always have to come to Vespers to satisfy this thirst after the Lord. You see, you can satisfy this thirst for the life which God has given us in what we would say are two different ways. Now, let's develop this a little bit further because it's rather significant. In Genesis, we have the crucial passage similar to the one in John 10. You have the passage which is translated, "In the beginning, God, you know, made man. He made him in his image. And he took the dust, and he breathed in the spirit." Look at the spirit here, I think, before we end. And watch the phrase. "Man became a living being." That's the RSV translation. Now, those of you who are here Monday know that the Hebrew doesn't have a word for to be. It has words for have, it has words for to become. And so the verb that's used is properly translated, just as it is in the RSV. "Man became a living being." Now, the word translated "living being" is this word. And that's the word that's translated "soul" in so many of our passages. And the Greek used the word "psuche" again, the psyche of man. Living being, not soul. We ought to get rid of that word, unless we understand it properly. In the Hebrew, man is, or man, if you want to say, using our language, becomes a soul, a being, a personality, whatever word you want to use. He doesn't have a soul. He doesn't have a soul. He is a soul.
Now, the reason we've fallen into this trap is the Gnostic, Platonic trap that Thomas Aquinas and some of the others developed in the Middle Ages, and that some of us have not quite known enough Hebrew to do anything about. Man is a living being. He is a totality. He is not divided into two parts, a good and a bad part, the flesh and the soul, or the body and the soul. Isn't divided like that at all. I'll talk about flesh and Paul in a moment. In the Greeks, though, you see, they didn't have this kind of picture. The Greeks had several pictures. I can't develop them all, but there was usually this picture of some kind of thing called the great world soul, sort of like a Platonic cloud up there. And every now and then, sometime at conception, or sometimes at the heartbeat, or sometimes at the moment of birth, or sometimes at the anointing of a particular religious initiation, a piece of this great soul broke off and was incarcerated. Watch this word. Was incarcerated. That means put in the flesh, and we use incarcerate to mean imprisoned, don't we? We imprisoned that little world soul in the flesh. So life then became a prison house, and we frequently think and sing about the prison house of sin. So asceticism crept into the Greek as well as into the Christian religion. The thing to do was to help that little soul get away from this prison. If I had the wings, I would fly. I'd get away from this world, get out of this horrible body with sex and beards and all that kind of nonsense. we get away. I put those deliberately together because some people think neither of them are too good. This is the way you do this, you see. And so you try to get rid of the body, you try to get rid of the flesh. Now, there are other theories of this. This is oversimplified. And then you see Christians fell into the trap, not the early Christians, not the Bible, but later Christians fell into the trap of forgetting what the Apostles' Creed said. The Apostles' Creed did not say that this little thing which came down here and then went back here, I believe in the immortality of the soul. They didn't say that. The New Testament doesn't teach the immortality of the soul. It has a doctrine of eternal life, true. It teaches the resurrection. I believe in the resurrection of the body. This is the confession. Because they're trying to celebrate the flesh, if I can steal that title from you, Ivar. They're trying to celebrate the flesh. Christ redeemed the whole man. And if they had said, I believe in the resurrection of the soul, or I believe in the immortality of the soul, there'd be nothing unique about Christianity. Every damn fool Greek around believed that. And unfortunately, half of the damn fool Lutherans do. This is part of the problem. We think in terms of Greek when we were saved by God, who wasn't Plato. Now, look at this other word. Jesus was incarnate. God was incarnate in the flesh. And by that, obviously flesh can't be evil. How could God live in what was evil, per se? Incarnate versus this. Now, you might take another way of looking at this thing then. If man became a living being, if man is a living organism, if man is not just body plus soul, or clay plus soul, or flesh plus soul, but he is a total individual, then redemption makes more sense. God didn't redeem our souls. God redeemed me. And when I sin, I don't sin just with my body. This is how we could get into that Puritan trap, you see, of thinking that sex ideas or desires are sinful, just in themselves. It isn't the body that sins. I sin. The totality of me. Wheeler Robinson, who's responsible for that corporate personality phrase, says this: the Old Testament does not know an incarcerated soul, but an animated body. An animated body. And the animus came from God's Spirit. Now, some Christians still read Wordsworth's famous poem, Ode on Intimations of Immortality, most blasphemous, most non-Christian poem ever written. And you hear it at many Lutherans' funerals. Because our birth is but a sleep and a forgetting. Forgotten how wonderful it was up there in paradise in the great world soul. And our hope is to get rid of this crazy old body and get back up there as quick as we can so that our soul can be free and easy. Christianity is the death of immortality, not the death of God, but the death of immortality. Christianity is the death of the soul. But Christianity is the redemption of the person. It is the celebration of the flesh, to swipe the term again. It is the redemption of the body, of the total me. Luther put it this way, and I don't know why we always go to the wrong parts of Luther. Some of the times when he was too philosophical, Luther said, God created the whole man. The whole man sinned. The whole man dies. The whole man is justified by Christ. And the whole man lives in heaven with Christ. The whole man, this is the phrase you ought to use, or as Carol uses it around here, the total person or total being. Now, how did this crazy body and soul get into the picture? I won't take a lot of time, but we're coming toward the close. It came in because you had a fellow named Paul, who was a Hebrew of the Hebrews, a Pharisee of the Pharisees, as he called himself. He knew the Old Testament. He knew that man was a unity. But he went over to talk to some Greeks. And if soul or nephesh in Hebrew equals totality or living being, how in the world do you tell these Papuans, who happened to be at this time not in New Guinea but over in Athens or in Corinth, how do you get that Hebrew concept over to them? Well, you go around and you listen to some of their teachers and you say, well, now, what's this and what's this and how do you say this and how do you say that? And finally, you build up a missionary vocabulary. You may have some lousy, some of you are missionaries and you know some of these vocabulary words. If you retranslate them back into English, they make horrible sense. You can't take the Papuan or the Telugu and bring it back into English without perverting it. Yet this is what we've done with Paul. Paul was a missionary. He spoke a missionary language. So he went around and he asked these people from the Athenian councils and schools and colleges, and he said, now how would I express the concept of totality? And all these little Platonists kept saying quite consistently, well, man, the total man is body and soul. So when Paul wanted to preach, what did he preach? He couldn't preach, now, Jesus redeemed your nephesh. Nephesh was Hebrew. These guys weren't interested in Hebrew. No Greek wanted to learn Hebrew. After all, Greek was God's language, like Norwegian. So what do we do about this? He says the total is body and soul. Body and soul. This is a Greek missionary term. Body and soul equals nephesh. Body and soul equals totality. Nephesh by itself equals totality. It's as simple as that. Oh, but somebody said, yeah, but Paul has this other idea, doesn't he? He has flesh and he has spirit. Yes, he does. But again, I refer you to the book Celebration of the Flesh because it's excellent on this point, except he's using that word flesh in the Pauline sense. And unless you read the book, you won't understand it. The flesh is not body. The spirit is not soul. This is our second error that we make with Paul. The flesh and the spirit. This is not an equal
We've got to draw those lines off of there. Flesh is the total man alienated from God. And that's why I'm afraid of the title. I'm not celebrating alien man. I want to celebrate redeemed man, or the total man even before he's redeemed. So flesh in Paul, as the chapter in the celebration on the flesh makes it, it's the totality that's away from God. And the spirit, if it's with a little letter, the spiritual man, he's the one who is related again with God. And how does he get related? Because God redeemed the totality of him in Jesus Christ. That's how he gets related. So now when a man dies, what happens? The Bible's not very clear. Only one person did it, Jesus Christ. When he came back to earth, we talked about the resurrection of the body. Didn't talk about immortal Jesus. Some of our songs talk about immortal Jesus, but that's, again, horrible Greek. Jesus, the immortal Jesus. We might talk about an immortal Christ, if you wish. You might want to talk about the immortal God, if you wish. But Jesus took on our flesh, and flesh is mortal. And then it was raised, the totality of Jesus. He ate, he was hungry, he was touched, he did things, he spoke, everything that you want to do. So what we've done, we've gotten this Greek concept of my picture up here. So at death, we take this hulk, as we call it, the body, the flesh, the corpse, and we act as if there's somehow been some kind of separation. And that the soul's up here, and here we're stuck with the flesh. It's not biblical at all. It's frequently Lutheranism, but it isn't biblical Lutheranism. And the resurrection then becomes a gluing job on the part of God. You know, he works in a laminating factory. And so he takes all this little body and he glues it together with the soul, and there I am, little old me up there again. Before that, it was only just a half-baked me up there, or even a little bit less than that, a little bit of a cloudy vapor. God doesn't do a laminating job. And the reason the Roman Catholic Church can now allow cremation is because they've realized that cremation is no longer the thumbing of the nose of the agnostic at the doctrine of resurrection. Ingersoll and some of the others, they were thumbing their nose at God and said, God, after I get my body good and burned, then I spray it all over the Atlantic Ocean and the whales and others eat it, and then the men get the whales and they make whale oil and fish oil lamps, and then they burn the lamps. I dare you to put me back together again. That's what the agnostic was saying, because the Christian church, you see, had already told him that's what God did. Now, if the Catholics and the Lutherans can get back to the Old and the New Testament and recognize that God doesn't do a laminating job, God does a recreating job. He revivifies me. He resurrects me. The total me. Don't preach the way that the preachers do so often, that this is only the shell and the nut is gone. I mean, this isn't the dichotomy that's involved. This isn't the dichotomy. So, the soul of man is, in the Old Testament, the totality of man. Paterson, a quite orthodox Lutheran Dane, made it very simply this way. To the soul of man pertains everything that he is. His reputation in the community, his mind, his love, and the more or less hairy quality of his skin. Now, I think that's almost as good as a Japanese poem. Because when you say that to the soul of man belongs the more or less hairy quality of his skin, you throw most Platonic Lutherans. Because it does. I'm going to have to quit pretty soon, but let's use one other illustration. This is all we're doing is getting back to psychosomatic medicine. The Hebrews knew it long before the doctors did. That my aggravations of my body come because of
my mind and my spirit, or vice versa. If I'm starved to death, I also have various ways of thinking that are a little bit peculiar too. You can't separate the two. You can't be pious in one way and sick in another way. I do a little marriage counseling too. And some of these kids who want to get married just before the guys get sent over to Vietnam, I'm very brutal. I said, do you really love this guy or do you think he's good looking? Because his soul is going to be different when he comes back from Vietnam. Whether he goes to a brothel or not, he's gone through something different. And if he comes back and a landmine has castrated him, will you still love him? If he comes back with only one leg, will you still love him? Because although you think you love the total being, to the soul of man belongs the two legs and the two arms, and two testicles. And if he comes back with less than that, his soul has changed. We act as if, no, the soul can't be changed. So if you lose a leg, your soul will change. Talk to some of the paraplegics. Oh, sure, lots of them have good Christian faith. But it's a different kind of faith, and they're a different total personality than they were before they lost those four limbs. But the total man is what God saved, God loves. Well, this is about all I can have time to do. As I say, Paul Gabrielson and our famous poet from St. Olaf have been in collusion with me here. Maybe between the three of us, we might get this point across, just to about 30, 40 of you here at Holden. But if you can get the message that this is what God did, God created the whole man, and that man was created in the image of God so that he could respond and be responsible for the whole creation, you could then properly be called a Christian, as the whole man redeemed you and with you the rest of creation. For you see, we're connected with that creation too. Joseph Sittler startled people at New Delhi when he said we ought to reinterpret the Greek Orthodox idea of the redemption of the cosmos. The church's duty is not just to redeem heathen in Africa, it's to redeem the world. And this is anything that's alien from God. For the whole creation groans and travails until now, waiting for the earnest revelation, which you have, for you are little Christs, and not just this little part in you, the total. Well, thank you for listening. We'll give you time tomorrow to answer questions. They decided to throw a tape on me today, and that's one of the reasons why I kept on going here like this. So that we'd see what happens. This way they can send it back to the Vatican, you see, and they'll know whether they're going to take my ordination papers away.